So I know I kind of had you learn a parak smack in the middle of Eicha, kind of without any context, just jumping right in. And the reason why I chose this specific parak is because it is it's pretty much known as the climax of Sefer Eicha, right? Sefer Eicha has five prakim. Aleph, Bet come before Perek Gimel, obviously, and Dalet and Hey come afterwards. And Perek Gimel is really known by many as being the climax. The rest of the Sefer kind of builds up towards it and then climbs back down from it. Perek Gimel is pretty similar to the other four prakim in some ways, and it's different from it in other ways. So the way that it's similar to the rest of the Megillah is, as one of you guys mentioned here, right, that every pasuk begins with a different letter of the alphabet in order. Prakim Aleph, Bet, and Dalet have 22, and Hey, all have 22 psukim. Hey is not in alphabetical order, but it still has 22 psukim. Aleph, Bet, and Dalet are all in alphabetical order, so pasuk Aleph starts with an Aleph, and pasuk Bet starts with a Bet. In Perek Gimel, the psukim are shorter, so we have three Alephs, and then three Bets, and then three Gimels. And it's therefore a much longer parak. But it still follows the same structure as the rest of the Megillah in that it does go from, you know, it does basically go from Aleph to Taf. And the reason why Yirmiyahu likely chose to write Megillat Eicha from Aleph to Taf is, first of all, to help with mnemonics, right, to help people memorize it and remember it so that they would be able to learn from it, because back then not everyone had access to the manuscripts, not everyone had access to the Svarim in Tanakh, and so it was easier to memorize something if you can know, oh, well, the next one starts with a gimel, so it must be this pasuk. But the second suggestion that has been made is that when we go from Aleph to Taf, we have a sense of completion, a sense of totality. And it has been suggested that Yirmiyahu, in writing Eicha from Aleph to Taf, wanted to give us a sense of the totality of the Chorban, the sense of the completeness of the destruction and how far it actually went. So that's the first way in which Perek Gimel is really just like all the other prakim in Megillat Eicha, and that it follows the same alphabet structure as most of them. The meter of Perek Gimel is also similar to the rest of the prakim. Again, the only notable exception is Perek Hey, only because it's no longer a kina, it's no longer a lamentation, it's kind of more like a tefillah, so it has a different meter. But what's interesting to note is that most shirim in Tanakh, most songs in Tanakh, have a balanced meter. So like if you think of Azashir, if you think of Shirat Devora, you have two halves of the pasuk that each are basically the same length. And that connotes a sense of security, a sense of balance. Everything is right in the world when things, you know, make sense in terms of meter. You know, when you're writing a poem, let's say, even for like a friend's birthday, you want to go, right, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, right? That just makes it sound better. That's just what a rhyme should be in our heads. However, in Megillat Eicha, we encounter in Prakim Aleph, Bet, Gimel, and Dalet a much longer first half of the pasuk than the second half. The second half kind of slows up, it weakens, it fizzles out. And that also gives us this sense of mourning, this sense of despair, this sense of I can't even handle this, right? You start out a little stronger and then you just kind of lose it. So in that way, Perek Gimel is like the rest of the Megillah. Just like the rest of the Megillah, it's not a historical description of the historical facts and events that made up the Chorban, but rather an emotional response to it. And finally, just like the other prakim in the Megillah, Perek Gimel ends with a tefillah. So I kind of just wanted to give you a sense of what you can expect for the other four prakim when you're in shul in Rosh Hashem in a little less than 3 weeks. But at the same time, Perek Gimel is very different and it stands out in its uniqueness. And it's, you know, really distinct from the other four prakim. How so? So the first thing that stands out is that Perek Gimel is all written in first person. The Ani that we encounter in the first word of the first pasuk continues speaking about himself throughout the entire parak. Whereas the other prakim in Sefer Eicha, in Megillat Eicha, are either all third person or they switch off between third and first. Perek Gimel is the only parak that is first person throughout the entire parak. Like we mentioned before, the psukim are a lot shorter than the other prakim. So we have three psukim per letter in the alphabet as opposed to one. But they're very, very short, like almost like staccato psukim. It's like, you know, punch, punch, punch. The third unique aspect of Perek Gimel is that we're no longer talking about national suffering. In Perek Gimel, we're dealing with a personal crisis of faith. It's about one man and his suffering. Whereas in Perek Aleph and in Bet and in Dalet, we're talking about the national tragedy, how Bnei Yisrael as a whole suffered, how Yerushalayim and all of its inhabitants are, or how Yerushalayim feels without its inhabitants. But it's more, it talks about the tragedy on a national scale, right, and the emotional response of the nation. Perek Gimel really focuses on the individual and his personal response to that same tragedy. And finally, the last thing that is unique is that every other parak in Eicha begins with the word Eicha. Eicha meaning Eich, how, but Eicha meaning how could this possibly have happened? Again, connoting a sense of national mourning. How could this have happened to our people? How could this have happened to our temple? How could this have happened to our city? Parak Gimel, as we've noted, begins with the word Ani. Instead of focusing outward, trying to understand what happened to the people, Perek Gimel focuses inward, trying to understand what happened to me, trying to understand what happened to the narrator. Right? There's a sudden focus on oneself. Just to sum up what makes Perek Gimel unique, we're really talking about one individual's relationship with Hashem, how he undergoes suffering and how his relationship with Hashem is affected by that. And at the same time, we see the progression, the development in the relationship between the narrator and Hashem himself. And we're going to see that the parak kind of is split into different stages, not exactly the way that I ordered the questions. Chronologically, yes, but not exactly in the same breakup. But we'll see that there really is a very important progression to be aware of as we go through the parak. So let's just go back for a moment to the Ibn Ezra that you learned in source number 2, all the way at the back of the packet. According to the Ibn Ezra, what are the two possibilities of who the Gever is? Who is the narrator of this parak? What are the two possibilities? Very good. Very good. So Rashi, and the Ibn Ezra quotes him as Kadmoneinu, right? Rashi and all the Medrashim assume that this is Yirmiyahu speaking about himself. Ani HaGever. I am the man who had to suffer through this. Why do they think it's Yirmiyahu? Because a lot of the images used in the parak to describe the suffering are really taken from Yirmiyahu's own life. He talks about being thrown in the pit or calling out to Hashem from a pit. We know that Yirmiyahu himself was thrown in a pit. He talks about being chained. We know that Yirmiyahu was also imprisoned. He talks about not being able to daven to Hashem. We know in Sefer Yirmiyahu, Hashem told Yirmiyahu he wasn't allowed to daven to him on behalf of the people. What else is there? We also have... What is the last thing? Oh, he talks about being the laughingstock of the people. That the people were making fun of him. We know that the people were constantly, mocking Yirmiyahu, telling him that he was really a Navi Sheker, not believing anything he said. So because a lot of the imagery really does seem to derive from what we know of Yirmiyahu's lifetime, the Medrash Chazal and Rashi believe that Yirmiyahu is now talking about himself. But the Ibn Ezra suggests an alternative understanding that, yes, of course Yirmiyahu wrote the Perek, just like he wrote the rest of the Prakim of Eicha, but it's possible that he was writing the Perek to be reflective of the experience of every individual in Klal Yisrael at the time. So yes, of course, he's going to use his own personal experiences, right, from which to draw inspiration. He's going to use the images of calling out to Hashem from a pit because he himself knows what that's like. But he doesn't think that he's the only one who was thrown in a pit, or at least metaphorically, everyone else in Bnei Yisrael could have thought at the time that they had been thrown, that they could have felt like they had been thrown in a pit. And so in this way, the Ibn Ezra helps us understand that Ani HaGever is really every man. It is every individual member of Bnei Yisrael's reaction, emotional, spiritual response to the Chorban. What does he call himself, by the way? He doesn't say Ani HaIsh. He doesn't say Ani HaAdam. What does he call himself? Ani HaGever. What is Gever? What does Gever mean? So what's the Shoresh of Gever? Gibor. What does Gibor mean? Strong. Does he strike you as a strong person in this parak? Not so much. He seems to be weakening under the weight of his suffering, not exactly strengthening from it, at least in the beginning. But what's interesting, something that I found fascinating, for a lot of this year, I was looking back in my notes from when I was in seminary, and my teacher at the time, Mrs. Browski, said something very interesting. She said, what's a gibor? He is someone who has to be strong. He is someone who has to use his physical strength to fight in a physical battle, right? A gibor is someone who goes to war. A gibor is how David was described after he was able to kill Goliath, right? A gibor is someone who uses his physical strength to fight in a crisis, in a physical crisis. Well, a gever, she explained, is someone who has to use their spiritual, emotional strength to fight in a crisis of faith, to fight in a more spiritual, emotional crisis. And so perhaps this is why he begins the perek saying, Ani hagever. I'm the man who is fighting. I'm the man who has to bring his strength to the fore in order to get myself through a crisis, because this is a real crisis. It may not be spilling my blood. It may not be, fighting with my arms and my sword, but it certainly is a crisis, and perhaps it's even worse than that. And so just putting this all together, the beginning of the perek, we see Ani Hagever. The narrator is demonstrating that he's completely focused on himself. He's focused inward. He is not even thinking about anyone else. And as he goes on and describes his suffering in the first 16 psukim, we really hear only about everything that's happening to him and everything that he's suffering through. He is immersed in darkness. He's imprisoned by his own suffering. And he is literally unable to look outside himself. Right? It's like he's become holed up in himself because the suffering is so intense. And he describes, for 16 psukim, the enemy that is making him suffer. Right? So if you even in Pasuk Aleph we see, Ra'a ani b'shevet evrato. I'm the man who has seen affliction through the staff of his anger. Well, who's he? Otinahag, he has led me, vayola choshech velo or, but he has led me through darkness and not light. And for 16 psukim, we're told everything that this enemy has done. And yet he can't even name him. He is so focused inward, he can't look outside of himself. Who do you think is the enemy here? So I think that there could possibly be many interpretations, but I think that the real interpretation, or not real, there's no such thing as real, but I think that one important interpretation here is Hashem himself. He is viewing in this case Hashem as the enemy. Because yes, even though the Balaam are the ones who may be meeting out some of it, and for Yirmiyahu himself, B'nai Yisrael themselves were his enemies, but it was all done, he knows, because Hashem enabled it. Hashem allowed it to happen. Why do you think he doesn't mention Hashem's name? Good. He's so focused on himself, and he feels so betrayed by Hashem. If Hashem is the one giving me this suffering, then I can't even deal with that. I can't reach out to him. I can't even think about him because I feel so distant from him. There's no relationship there anymore. Right? If there was a close friend who then turned her back on you, would you want to reach out to her? I mean, that's really, really hard to take. And so Yirmiyahu, or every man, however we want to view it, feels so distant from Hashem and so betrayed by him, he can't even name him. He can't even address him for who he is. But then in Psukim Yud Zayin and Yud Chet, he reaches rock bottom. He takes all this suffering, and he completely falls. He says, "Vatiznach mishalom, I have been removed completely from peace. Sorry, Vatiznach mishalom nafshi, my soul has been removed from peace. Nashiti tova, and I had even forgotten what goodness even is. Va'omar avad nitzli, and I said that my life is gone. V'tochalti mehashem, and my hope from Hashem is completely gone." And here, the narrator has hit rock bottom. He has completely given up. He has given up on ever attaining anything positive, peace or goodness. And he feels that he has lost everything, his life and his own God. And yet perhaps it is this very mention of Hashem's name that enables him to reach up from rock bottom and find an opening through which to build himself back up, to create or strengthen that relationship that he once had with Hashem. And in fact, what I found really fascinating is the next two psukim. After he has hit rock bottom, and here in Yutet and Chaf, we're going to see a turning point, because Chaf Aleph is going to be a complete reversal. So in Aleph through Tet Zayin, we see him going further and further down, completely engulfed in his suffering, not even being able to name his enemy by name, not responding, not referring to Hashem even once. In Yud Zayin and Yud Chet, he has hit complete rock bottom, in which he is completely despaired, and he even says that God has abandoned me. He says it. But it's almost as if saying Hashem's name, finally being able to face his enemy, enables him to relate to him in a certain way. What I find really interesting, like I said, is the next two psukim. What act is the narrator involved in psukim Yutet and Chaf? Zachar ani umerudi la'anav arosh. I remember my suffering, my affliction. Zachor tiskor v'tashuach alay nafshi. I remember and my soul can't even handle it. What act is he engaged in? Remembering. So what I find fascinating about this is that now he is no longer bent under the burden of his affliction. It's almost as if he's taken a step back. It's almost as if the suffering has let up a teeny tiny bit to the point that he feels that he can remember it. He can distance himself from it just enough that it feels like it was in the past. And as I learned from Alyssa Zephyrin this morning, from Mrs. Zephyrin, who gave a share at the Oriental Institute, or after the Oriental Institute tour that we ran, Mrs. Zephyrin quoted a book called Zahor, written by Mr. or Professor? Yes. Professor Yerushalmi, who explained, which I thought was really fascinating, what the Jewish approach to history is. And he explained that real history, secular history, the way that history is understood, is that we record events as they happen. Right? To learn history means to learn the events as they happened. And Professor Yerushalmi claims that that's not a part of Jewish consciousness at all. What is a part of Jewish consciousness? Zechira, memory. Zachor asher salacha Amalek. Zecher li yitziat Mitzrayim. Zecher maaseh bereishit. Right? Remember what Miriam did to you. Right? And Mrs. Zephyrin brought in a pasuk from Shirat HaAzinu. Zachor yimot olam. Binu shnot dor vador. Not record the events of history, but remember the events of history. So what is the difference between recording and remembering? Professor Yerushalmi explains that Zechira, as Mrs. Zephyrin explained to me, Zechira means not just recording things as they happened, but remembering them and learning from them. Interpreting history and trying to understand what the messages are. What am I supposed to learn from this and apply to my daily life? What I find really interesting is that the turning point in Perek Gimel, From the two psukim that take us from the point at which the narrator hits rock bottom to the following pasuk in Chafalach, what he says, Zot ashiv elibi al kein ochil, this is what I will take upon my heart, and now I have hope. The turning point is an act of zechira. The turning point is this act of being able to remember, of looking back upon the past and not just suffering through it, not just, you know, completely being run over and hit in the face by a ton of bricks by the suffering, but being able to try to learn from it, to try to comprehend what message might be going on here. And it's through this act of zechira, through remembering what happened, through understanding that it's not only about what happened, but it's really about interpreting its lesson so that I can continue in my avoda, right, in my avoda Hashem, so I can continue to be a good person and fulfill Ritzon Hashem, that's what enables him to lift up a little bit from rock bottom. And so Pasuk Chaval, if we continue, Zot Hashiv Elibi, right, this is what I will take to my heart, the Zechira, perhaps. Right, this act of remembrance, this act of understanding that maybe there's meaning behind the suffering, maybe there's something I can learn from it, maybe there's something I can apply to my life, and that's when he begins to have hope. To the point that in the very next pasuk, he finally mentions Hashem's name. Chaste Hashem ki lo tamnu ki lo chalu rachamav. Hashem's chasadim will never end, and his rachamim will never cease. And from here on in, from literally psukim, chaf aleph through lamed tet, suddenly the narrator is doing the complete opposite of what he was doing in aleph through tet, through yudchet, really. Right? The first few psukim, he was totally and completely engulfed by his suffering. That's all he was doing, and he was looking inside himself and he couldn't see anyone else. Now suddenly he engages with Hashem and he describes Hashem as being kulo tov. If you turn, actually skip just really quickly to psukim chaf hey, right, tov Hashem lekovav, tov yachiel, tov lagever, and he suddenly starts describing Hashem in these, like, seeing Hashem through these rose-colored glasses. I thought that my suffering was taking over me, but now I understand that really he's all good. He's all good. It's all good. It's all perfect. It's fine. But then we have yet another shift. Because in Pasuk Mem, so let me just be clear for a moment. Aleph through Yudchet, we have the narrator suffering and only being able to think about himself. Yotzer and Chaf, we have this zechira, looking back at the suffering with a kind of, well, what can I learn from this attitude? And then in Chaf Aleph, to Lam and Tet, we have a reversal, and suddenly he's reaching out to Hashem, he's engaging with Hashem, he views Hashem as all good. But then in Pasuk Mem, we have a shift from the first person singular, me, I, 2, what do we see in Pasuk Mem? Nach pasadrachinu v'nach kora. Who's he talking about now? Not I or me, but what's nach pasadrachinu v'nach kora? We. Let us search our ways and investigate v'nashuva ad Hashem. And let us do tshuva. Suddenly in Pasuk Mem, he goes from worrying only about himself to including the kahal, to including the community, to viewing himself as a part of a greater whole. And he reconnects to the people around him at the same time as he's reconnecting to Hashem, Nashuva ad Hashem. Let's do tshuva. For the first time, instead of being descriptive of everything that's happening to him, the narrator is saying, let's do something. Let's actively engage in correcting things. Let's try our hardest to change things as they are. And for the next several psukim, I believe it's Mem through Memchet, he talks about what they can do. And what's interesting is that he goes back to talking about the evil that has happened to him. He goes back to talking about what bad has occurred. Why do we go from terrible things to, oh my gosh, Hashem is all good, to, oh yeah, things are pretty bad? What is going on here? So I think that the answer, well, let me just add in one thing. And then after he talks about tshuva, he ends with a tefillah. He asks Hashem to destroy his enemies. But as opposed to the beginning of the parak when he viewed Hashem as his enemy, now he understands who his true enemy is, the Bavlim. And he asks Hashem for help in his tefillah to engage, to take away those enemies. And so just to see the progression in the relationship between the narrator and Hashem for a moment, we begin with a complete, feeling completely engulfed by suffering and only focusing inward. Then we have a turning point in which he engages, he remembers, and he says, well, what can I learn from this? Suddenly, he's reaching out to Hashem and describing Hashem as all good. And then he makes the next leap, and he's engaging in the community, and he is engaging in active tshuva and active tefillah. How can we understand this progression from A to B to C, and maybe even to D? The Rav, Rav Soloveitchik, bless you, wrote an essay in Hebrew called Kol Dodi Dofek, which has been translated into English, and it's called Fate and Destiny. And you'll see why it wasn't translated. Kol Dodi Dofek means the voice of my beloved knocks. Well, you'll see in a moment why it was translated into Fate and Destiny. It's pretty short. It's not an easy read because it's the Rav, and he wrote it himself, but it's a translation, so it's not so bad. And in it, and this I really have to attribute to Mrs. Brodsky, this was totally and completely not my idea, but I thought it was so beautiful I had to share. The Rav explains that there are really two different ways in which man can relate to suffering, and really how he can relate to the world in the midst of suffering. The first way he explains is through the perspective of Ish HaGoral, man of fate. What does that mean to be an Ish HaGoral, to believe in fate? Well, what does fate mean? Oh, it was fate. What do people mean when they talk about fate?
It's very passive. They're being acted upon.
Very good. It's a passive existence in which life is acting upon the human being. Human being does not have any control over the circumstances. He doesn't have any control over his environment. Things happen to him. And he is just kind of like this passive object that just kind of goes through life and waits for things to happen to him. And the Rav explains that when a man with the perspective of Ish HaGoral, when a man views life as approaching him with fate, that everything happens to him, that he's just an object who is passive, then what happens is he goes through two stages when he suffers. The first reaction is that his suffering completely overwhelms and engulfs him. This is all in the Rav, okay? First, his suffering overwhelms him, crushes him, engulfs him so completely, and he feels that he is in the midst of chaos and confusion, and he's panic-stricken. He literally doesn't know what to do. And he explains that he groans under the weight of his agony. He just feels like there's nothing that can be done, and he doesn't feel Hashem's presence at all. Well, if you think about it, that is exactly what is described to us in Psukim Aleph through Yudchet. Ani HaGever is just describing his suffering, and he's only focusing on himself, and he can't think about anything else or anyone else. It's only about the pain he feels. And he's just describing what happened to him. He's not doing anything. He's just telling us what happened to him. The only time he even mentions Hashem's name is at the very end when he says, and I don't even have hope in Hashem. And that's exactly how the Rav explains this first reaction to suffering by Ishar Goral, that he feels completely distant from Hashem. But then the Rav says, once the suffering has passed and he can look back upon it, right, engage in Sechira a little bit, reflect upon it, the Rav says that Ishar Goral tries to intellectualize suffering. He tries to understand, why do bad things happen to good people? Why does evil happen in this world? The problem is, says the Rav, that when he tries to intellectualize it, he comes to the self-delusional answer of, everything's really good. Hashem is really, really good, and there's really no evil. And the Rav explains, I thought it was really fascinating the way he explains it. He said, yes, that's true, but man cannot comprehend that. He says, yes, we believe that from Hashem's perspective, everything is tov, everything is good. But man, because we have finite understanding of Hashem, because we have limited knowledge of the world, we cannot possibly conceive of how everything can be good. And so if man tries to claim to himself that everything is good and that evil does not really exist, he's really just deluding himself. And he's not engaging in the world in the way that he should based on his finite understanding of that world. Well, that's exactly what we see in the second stage of Perek Gimel. Rayim Sukim Chaf, well, really Chaf through Lamatet. Suddenly, he is responding to Hashem and engaging with Hashem, but describing him as Tov, 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 everything's good, everything's great, nothing's so bad. The Rav explains, though, that the ideal in Judaism is to transform ourselves from Ish HaGoral to what he calls Ish HaYi'ud, man of destiny. What's destiny? When man is in control of his life. When man can shape his future. When man can be active and play an active role and believes that he should take an active role in his own life. And so the Rav explains that instead of trying to delude himself into thinking that evil does not exist in the world like the Ish HaGoral, the Ish HaYi'ud in fact confronts evil head on. And instead of asking the impossible question of why does bad happen to good people, because by the way, when Eel asked that question of Hashem, you know what Hashem's answer was? Do you know me? Do you know how I run the world? How can you possibly ask that question, and how can you ever answer it? You can't. When Hashem comes to Eel out of the whirlwind, Minasa Ara, which is, by the way, one of the few things that we still technologically haven't completely we can't control the weather, which I think is fascinating, that Hashem came to Eel in a whirlwind. I think that by itself is instructive. He says to Eov, you ask why this happened to you? You can never understand that. That's the answer to Eov. The answer to Eov of why bad things happen to good people is you will never understand. We as human beings have finite knowledge. And so the Rav says, obviously the answer to the question of why bad things happen is totally and completely beyond us. So what are we supposed to do in the face of suffering? So the Rav explains that the Ish HaYi'ud, the man who believes that he is in control, doesn't ask why this happened, but what can I do now? What path shall I take to relieve me of this suffering? What path shall I take now that this suffering has happened? What can I do about it? Not why, but what. And what's so fascinating is that this is exactly what the narrator in Perek Gimel begins to do in Pasuk Mem. He begins to, first of all, associate himself with the rest of the community, and he says, let's do tshuva. Not only does he talk about doing tshuva and being active, but remember we spoke about how instead of deluding himself into thinking that evil doesn't exist, he confronts evil head on. He says, okay, evil does exist. Now what do I do about it? Well, right after he talks about doing tshuva, the narrator in Perek Gimel also says, you know what, things are pretty bad. And he goes back to describing the evil that he experienced. And then he continues and he offers up a tefillah to Hashem. He says, Hashem, help. Help me destroy my enemies. Again, engaging actively in his own reconnection to Hashem himself. Instead of trying to intellectualize his suffering away, he addresses it head on. Instead of asking why, he asks, well, what can I do from here? And so I hope that we can understand now in Perek Gimel how what Yirmiyahu is doing is he's really reflecting upon how man deals with the crisis of faith. How first we may feel when we're suffering that there is absolutely nothing we can do. And we are just so engulfed in our pain, we can't think about anyone else, we can't extricate ourselves from it, we can't even think about what to do, we just feel it. then if we take a moment to kind of reflect on it, right, to do the zechira, to kind of derive lessons from it, well, our first reaction may be to intellectualize it and delude ourselves into thinking, oh, yeah, it's all good, it's all fine, and try to ignore the evil that's happened. But really what Yirmiyahu is teaching us is that the ideal is to confront the evil head on and to say, okay, I may not understand why, but I can answer the question of what. Let me be proactive. Let me do something. What am I supposed to do in the face of suffering? I'm supposed to come closer to Hashem. I may not know what flaw in my personality led to the suffering, and I'm not going to point fingers at myself or others to try to understand why the suffering happened. No, I'm just going to try to become a better person. I'm just going to show Hashem that I'm trying, that I'm reconnecting, that I'm davening, that I'm doing everything I can. And so what's fascinating is that whereas the parak begins with the word ani, what is the last word of the parak? Hashem. And so Yirmiyahu describes this person as starting out being so completely focused on himself and ultimately progressing in his relationship with Hashem until the point that he completely understands Hashem's place in his world and Hashem's role in everything that he has experienced. And so Perek Gimel is really the climax, as we discuss, of Megillat Eicha. We understand the national tragedy, and we understand from Prakim Aleph and Bet and Gimel and even Dalet and even Hey, you know, what happened to the nation. But it's also important as we learn Megillat Eicha and Tisha B'Av that we understand that we can't ignore the individuals. Yes, we always think of Bnei Yisrael as like a mass, right? Yeah, Bnei Yisrael did this and Bnei Yisrael did that. But really they were made up of individuals. And each one of them probably did experience a crisis in faith when their God destroyed his own temple and they were kicked out of their land and killed all their family. What else would they experience? And so what I think is really important and valuable to learn from Perek Gimel is that it's not just describing the crisis in faith, but it's also teaching us how to deal with it, how to best bring ourselves up from it, how to bring ourselves up from rock bottom and embrace the world and embrace Hashem and how to deal with it proactively as an Isha Yud, as a man of destiny. So I hope we never have to apply the lessons of Perek Gimel to our own lives, but I hope that it can help us understand Megillat Eicha in Shul as we learn it. Thank you so much.